This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Bloomington Normal defense attorneys analyze the Derek Chauvin murder trial in Minnesota and how it would be handled if it happened in central Illinois.
I do think that it would be a much more difficult case here. I do think that they would charge it, but it would be a tough case.
Plus, Bloomington Normal landlords say deadbeat tenants aren't accepting available help on water fees, and the property owners are getting stuck with a bill. And it's the WGLT Fund Drive. If you're listening, you should be supporting WGLT and public media with your financial contribution at WGLT.org. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for Sound Ideas comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, the best hearing device center in the Pantograph Reader's Choice Awards for the sixth year in a row. Bloomington Normal Audiology thanks the listeners and their continued vote of confidence as the leaders in hearing and technology. With a practice featuring five doctors, including two who wear hearing devices themselves, BNA takes a genuine interest in each patient and helps you keep hearing the most important sounds of your life. More information at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. The Bloomington Normal school districts say more students are being quarantined due to COVID as more cases among children are reported. Ryan Denham has more.
District 87 says 93 students were quarantined last week for COVID-like symptoms or because they were in close contact with a positive case. Eight students tested positive themselves. In the larger Unit 5 district, there were 400 students newly quarantined, with 55 testing positive. McLean County Health Department says youth sports, particularly those played indoors, are driving the spike. Another factor is that children under 16 can't yet get vaccinated. I'm Ryan Denham.
McLean County added more than 9,000 COVID-19 vaccine doses over the weekend. About 37,500 county residents are fully vaccinated. That's more than 21.5% of the population, still about a percentage point behind the state average. County health officials report the highest weekend caseload in nearly 3 months, with 164 cases. The new cases were found in a batch of about 3,100 test results returned since Friday. Hospitalizations held at a record 45 COVID patients. Bed capacity is up slightly, but still just 4% of all beds are open. The active caseload climbed over 600, with 561 county residents isolating at home. An additional 148 people are now considered recovered. Bloomington City Manager Tim Gleason has removed the interim tag from Eric West's title as Bloomington Fire Chief. West has served in the interim role since last November when Chief Brian Moore announced his retirement. Gleason says the city interviewed 9 candidates for the post.
Eric just rose to the top as being that steady hand, a stellar career, very respected amongst his peers throughout the state in the region, Midwest region. And just seemed the logical choice to the team.
Gleason said he wants to see West expand diversity hiring within the department and explore whether the department should relax its paramedic requirement for entry-level firefighters. Consumer advocates are pushing Illinois to adopt right-to-repair laws to give consumers the resources to fix their own equipment when it breaks. Terry Ballantini with Normal Gadget says business has been good since the pandemic, but Apple and other manufacturers make it difficult even for electronic stores to make basic repairs.
This is pretty serious. I mean, it really has been. I mean, COVID has kind of dramatized the fact that people are home on their devices more than ever and breaking their devices more than ever. But, you know, what happens when your Apple store is closed because of the pandemic?
The Illinois Public Interest Research Group says John Deere makes it hard for farmers to fix their tractors, and many ventilators went unused for weeks last year because only the manufacturer could fix them. Republicans in the General Assembly are pushing back on a new child tax credit proposal from a Chicago Democrat. They say Governor J.B. Pritzker has already put a slew of tax credits on the chopping block to help balance Illinois' budget. State Senator Don DeWitt is a Republican from St. Charles. He says approving new tax credits this year would be difficult to justify as lawmakers weigh whether to follow Pritzker's recommendations for eliminating more than $1 billion in annual tax credits.
While Senator Simmons' intent is certainly understood and appreciated, it has the wrong effect on the state budget.
The credit would cost an estimated $750 million in tax revenue. If approved, the credit could be applied when parents file taxes next year. Illinois prisons are starting to allow in-person visitation for the first time in over a year. The Illinois Department of Corrections says all of the state's prisons will soon reopen visiting rooms. East Moline Correctional Center has already started allowing visitation. At remaining centers, it will be phased in over the next few weeks. The Corrections Department suspended visitation in March of last year to try to prevent the spread of COVID-19. According to state data, Illinois prisons held more than 29,000 inmates as of the end of last year. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's educational video series, Hear My Story, continues with local patient Gina Barnhart.
The first time I tried hearing aids, it was too overwhelming. But then once I didn't have them, then it was kind of like, oh, I kind of miss hearing some of those sounds.
Gina's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Some Bloomington landlords are getting stuck with huge water bills their tenants aren't paying during the pandemic. Water shutoffs have been on pause for the last year to protect people economically hurt by COVID. Some landlords say a few tenants take advantage of the opportunity. Dana Vollmer reports the landlords are on the hook for months of unpaid bills.
Landlord Janice Hollins recently got a surprise, a bill for nearly $200,000 in unpaid water charges from a unit she and her husband own. Hollins says this was the first they'd heard of the overdue bill. By the time they received notice from the city, nearly a year's worth of bills had stacked up. The city gave them 15 days to get current on the accounts or face possible legal action, including a lien on their property. In non-pandemic times, Hollins says the solution would be simple.
The incentive that works is the shutoff notice. Trust me when I tell you that I have firsthand witnessed when that shutoff notice arrives at the tenant's house, guess what they do? They pay the water bill.
Bloomington put a hold on water shutoffs last March. It coincides with the statewide eviction moratorium meant to prevent people suffering during the pandemic from ending up homeless. Holland says that's not who's pushing the limits.
We have a lot of phenomenal tenants, but it's these outliers that are really causing a problem. And hear me good. This is not a money problem, okay? This is a mentality problem.
Holland says 90% of tenants are doing their best to keep up, including restaurant workers and CNAs who lost their jobs during the pandemic. But she says the other 10% are aware of the moratorium and not budging. Holland says while the $2,000 bill is the highest, there are others. In total, she says they're on the hook for about $6,000 in backlogged water bills. Holland says they've tried to offer assistance to tenants with no luck.
There is money available. We have provided the resources to our tenants. We have provided applications. I have offered to give transportation to get them to the agencies that will help with the water bill. There's no incentive. They know that they're not going to be held responsible for this.
Holland says the same tenants that are blowing off utility bills also aren't paying rent. She says that's left her and her husband cash strapped for things like property taxes and repairs to furnaces and busted pipes over the winter. Holland says she doesn't expect to ever get that money back. She says the amount due now is too large for tenants to afford, and there's nothing for her as a landlord to go after in small claims court. But if the Hollands want to keep renting the unit after that tenant leaves, they'll have to pay off the account.
That bill is simply going to be handed to the property owner. And if the property owner wants to get that water bill put into another tenant's name, it must be paid back down to zero.
Holland says this practice never made sense to her, pandemic or not. And when the moratorium on evictions is up, she says her tolerance will also end.
If tenants have been blatantly, you know, disrespectful in being fiscally responsible for themselves in either the water bill or the rent, they're going to have to go. I mean, we're going to start procedure against them. Mm-hmm. I hate to see that happen to people, but there comes a point where the line has to be drawn in the sand.
Holland says they're not the only landlords dealing with this problem. Deputy City Manager Billy Taya says he's heard from a few, and the city is looking at solutions. Taya says he understands their frustration.
Ultimately, it is the property owner that is responsible for the property. Having said that, we have worked to try and create programs in a situation where there's flexibility in payback for some of the things that could be owed.
Taya says that could mean reducing the amount that has to be paid immediately and allowing the account to be paid off over a longer stretch of time. Taya says another option is ending the moratorium on water shutoffs, but that decision involves weighing economic and health impacts from the pandemic on everyone in the community.
While we're talking about renters and landlords, which is it's important, this elimination of shutoffs and the other options that we provided, they apply to other people as well. They apply to homeowners. They apply to business owners. They apply to people, again, as I said earlier, who in some cases are still struggling financially and who are still struggling from a health perspective. And we're still a community where COVID is very real.
In the meantime, Taya says property liens are on hold. The Bloomington City Council will take up the issue. In a memo to the council, city staff note most utility moratoriums statewide are no longer in effect more than a year after the pandemic began. I'm Dana Vollmer.
The Bloomington City Council is also taking up the issue.
Good evening, and thanks for choosing WGLT for our award-winning news magazine, Sound Ideas. I'm Dina Vollmer with Jennifer Armstrong during our spring fund drive. We're asking everyone who can contribute to do so right now at WGLT.org. Every day, the WGLT newsroom brings you the stories that help you understand the day's news, the latest on vaccinations, elections, and more. And Sound Ideas brings you in-depth stories about health, community events, and newsmakers you can't hear from anywhere else.
When you donate at WGLT.org, your contribution powers Sound Ideas, the Leadoff podcast, and a local newsroom of award-winning journalists. Quality news and programming worthy of your financial support. Donate now at WGLT.org. There's no subscription fee to listen to or read our stories. Everyone can access this essential public service thanks to community support. You get something of value from us. That's why you're listening. It's time for you to put something back in during this fund drive so we can meet our goal. Please contribute now at WGLT.org.
What you can't see as a listener of WGLT is what it takes to bring you the news, both locally and from around the world. Our journalists ask tough questions, gather facts, and double-check every story. NPR and WGLT report credible news and facts, not opinions or the latest social media gossip. It's the Spring Fund Drive, and if you want more facts instead of fiction in our community, your financial support is the power we need. Give now at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington Normal defense attorneys Josh Rinker and Jeff Brown say they're a lot like the rest of the nation in periodically finding they have lost track of work for a bit and watched the trial of Derek Chauvin, the police officer accused of murdering George Floyd in Minneapolis. Rinker and Brown talk with correspondent Edith Brady Lunny about what the case might look like in McLean County. Both are former prosecutors. In smaller towns, prosecutors often have close personal relationships with police officers, as well as professional ones, which can make it difficult to file charges against cops. Jeff Brown says the case of a serial rapist shows that is not the history in Bloomington Normal.
Probably it depends on the crime. I mean, for instance, the Pilo case, there was no one from the police department getting behind Pilo. He was friends with a lot of police officers, and he was one of the team until they figured out what he'd been doing. Judge Yoder was the state's attorney at the time, and Mark Messman and Sandy Thompson tried that one, and it was stressful. A lot of prosecutors lost a lot of weight that year.
Right.
But everybody went at it 100%, and I think the investigation through the Bloomington Police Department was top-notch. Now, if it was something that was a little closer to the line in the gray area, I think that it would be more difficult to maintain some of those relationships.
The other case that comes to mind to me was the 2013 case of Gabriella Calhoun. I don't know if you remember that case, but yeah. She was a younger college student. who was involved in an altercation with police at Denny's. She was the one who was charged with an aggravated battery, and she was acquitted by a jury. It turned on more on the police conduct than her conduct in many respects. One of the things about that case, too, was that there was video available to show her reaction to being harmed by a police officer during that altercation. What difference does it make now that we have, of course, in the Chauvin case, the video evidence is just overwhelming. Yeah. How do you think that plays into the prosecution of a case, Josh?
I think it plays a major role, and it's, you know, certainly as a defense attorney, I welcome video evidence. It's always my position that the more evidence I have, the less guesswork we have to do about what happened. We can still argue about interpretation of what that video evidence shows, but it eliminates so much ambiguity. From all the law enforcement I've talked to, other than the, you know, the training and the additional expense to the agencies, which I certainly understand, I think they welcome it, because no more can there be these allegations that something happened that didn't. We simply play Monday morning quarterback and review the footage.
Yet it's still hard, isn't it, Jeff, to get charges filed in cases where there's allegations of abuse by police. Why is it still so hard, do you think? I mean, we see more settlements in police cases than we do charges and trials.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think back to all the way to Rodney King. I think there was some video in the Rodney King case back in the 90s. And there's a long history going back at least that far, because I don't remember much before that, of police officers on video committing these types of acts, and they're still acquitted. There was just a case down in St. Louis where one police officer was acquitted and two police officers, it was a mistrial. They were tried for beating up an actual undercover police officer. All over the country, there's been video of police officers in these situations. And I think juries want to believe that police officers are always good, because the alternative might not be such a great thing to think about. I think the majority of them are. I'm friends with many police officers in Bloomington, and they're good people. That makes it harder when there's one that goes rogue.
Is there backlash in the community, do you think? I mean, this has raised questions and commentary across all communities in the country about their own police departments and what might be possible. Do you think it makes it hard for local police when trials like this are going on, Josh?
I absolutely do. Granted, I'm not on the street at 1 a.m., you know, dealing with an intoxicated subject, so I wouldn't even begin to know what that's like. But I definitely think they're feeling the heat, and whether or not they've done anything wrong themselves. I mean, we might have a complete Boy Scout on our hands. In that interaction, you have to imagine, with the political climate we're dealing with and with the, you know, seemingly tense race relations between certain law enforcement agencies and just the Black Lives Matter movement, it's probably running through the back of everyone's mind. And that's not just law enforcement, but also the potential subject in that case. My personal concern is that raising the tension for each of these interactions, whereas it might not have been there before? And are we perceiving slights that don't exist on both sides, both from law enforcement as well as from a potential subject? I don't know, but that would be my concern. Are we creating a powder keg environment that is meant to bust? Yeah, it's very scary.
Jeff, do you have friends who are law enforcement? And I hear from some of them that they're thinking about early retirement because of some of the situation that they're seeing across the country, that they're concerned that they're not going to be able to effectively do their job after some of these things have happened. Do you hear that from them as well?
Absolutely. That's what I'm hearing, is that it's made a difficult job, even more difficult, maybe unbearable for some police officers. You know, it's easy for people to judge how they handle things later on, and the police officers I talk to are kind of frustrated right now.
When you have a client like a Derek Chauvin you still have to try to put together a defense for them. Yeah. How do you approach something like that when you only have to work with what you have to work with, right?
Absolutely. As defense lawyers, we often get a bad rap sometimes, as you know. You're maybe unfairly connected to the allegation of your client, but you're absolutely right. There's an obligation to pursue to the fullest extent of the law and within the confines of ethics, defenses for your client. And in this case, I think that video evidence is tough. I would start with the charges. Okay, what has to be specifically proven? And even if we can all agree that some things happened and get past it, right? The 9 minutes and what was it, 47 seconds. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to be able to dispute that that occurred. There's a video of it, but there's certainly a mental state component to this. They got to prove that it was intentional or knowingly. And they're going to have to prove, at least for the more serious offense, that it occurred during the commission of a felony offense. I think the underlying felony here for Derek Chauvin was assault and battery, the Minnesota equivalent of that. So they're going to have to prove that this wasn't unintentional in the sense that, hey, I'm just trying to subdue this guy, but I'm intentionally battering him and he accidentally died as a result of that battery. I think that's a big hill to get over from a state's perspective. But there's a lesser offense here, that third degree murder. Right. Which seems to be much more akin to our reckless homicide. I think that's probably the more problematic charge for Derek Chauvin. If I was his defense attorney, that would be the advice and counsel I would be providing him.
Part of the trial, too, on the defense side, is trying to point out that Chauvin had drugs in his system. Mm-hmm. Is there a risk, Jeff, in maybe crossing a line there where you're blaming the victim? How do you walk that fine line?
Oh, that's always the question in these cases.
With an eraser.
Right. I'm putting myself in the defense lawyer's shoes, and maybe that's all they have. Maybe they're like, okay, well, let's give this a shot because we're kind of out of options here.
The jury in the Chauvin case is pretty diverse. You have several black men and women on the jury. And you have a couple people who identify as biracial on the jury. Do you think we could get that kind of diversity on a jury in McLean County? Would that be possible?
When I think back to the jury pools that I have typically had to select from, whether or not my client is an African-American or whether they're Caucasian or Hispanic or whatever, the traditional pool that I have had to choose from has been predominantly Caucasian. And I would say on average, one or two, typically African-Americans in my jury pool. In most cases of a normal, you know, offense, something like this, you'd bring in a much bigger pool, obviously. You're looking at what, Jeff, 35 typically in the room from?
Yeah, 35, and maybe you get two minority
folks in there. Two individuals would be identified as people of color of some, you know, race or ethnicity. And so I think it's doubtful that you would get such a diverse jury here. Now, that's not a criticism of McLean County. It's the demographics that we live in. And in this case, I think it's important to note that I don't believe Derek Chauvin's identified it as any sort of racial minority, as I understand it. So he'd probably qualify as a Caucasian, a white guy. And so the law as it exists doesn't necessarily require him to have a diverse racial makeup or for opposing sides to not remove people because of race necessarily the way it would in a Batson challenge here, where you could do that if your client was an African-American.
Right. And you were found to deliberately knock them off or out of the jury pool. That would be a problem.
Yeah.
So what kind of problem would that present to you? Jeff, as a defense lawyer, have you had a similar situation? Do you?
Well, it might be the opposite of what the state usually wants. I mean, I think the state would want as many minorities on the jury as possible because minorities have experienced or more likely to experience, you know, a more aggressive police officer maybe, whereas, you know, a white guy like me doesn't run into that generally. So it might be just the opposite of what they normally would want. And I was thinking about Batson. Batson basically said that a police or the state can't knock minorities off of the jury pool just because they're a minority. And this would be the opposite of that. And I don't know how that works. I do think that it would be a much more difficult case here. I do think that they would charge it, but it would be a tough case.
Bloomington Normal defense attorney Jeff Brown says it's noteworthy that a $27 million civil settlement in the Chauvin case happened before the criminal trial. Brown says that might be because the city thought it might be worse after the trial. Brown and attorney Josh Rinker spoke with correspondent Edith Brady Lunny. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories at WGLT.org. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLT-FM, or follow us on Twitter, we're all at WGLT News. This is WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.